It's a joy to see you all this evening. I decided it would be easier on you to inflict a class than to inflict a film that I thought maybe many of you would not enjoy either. So at least you'll learn something from the class, I hope. I don't know how much you would have gotten from the film. But there are three reasons that I thought it would be appropriate to have this satsang tonight. One is that we have two visitors who will be leaving in a couple of days, and since I won't have time to have private meetings, I wanted to be able to wish you both blessings on your life journey from here and to give you whatever last guidance or answers to any questions that you might have this evening. Because I think that conditions are going to be very difficult and increasingly so in the world out there. So that's the second reason for the satsang tonight, which is to go over the current events, at least some of them, that are having a very large impact on the state of the world and of the state of consciousness and the consequences of the current hysteria and the very poor decisions that are being made by people of relative amounts of power in the world and where that is taking us and how quickly. So that's two. And then the third reason is that we have coming up this week the beginning of the study group about the Tao of the final days, and I thought it would be useful to contextualize what is the Tao of Sat Yoga exactly, and how does this concept help us and guide us in our own sadhana. So I hope that's a valid enough reason for holding the class. Well, since I've already given my bon voyage, I'll go to the second point, which is that the war hysteria over Russia's demilitarization operation in the Ukraine, which is apparently nearly over successfully for Russia in a rather amazing blitzkrieg operation. The Ukrainian Navy is destroyed, the Air Force seemingly is, the land forces are apparently surrounded in two different cauldrons and are really in a hopeless situation. I think Russia hopes they will surrender so it doesn't have to pick them off in a turkey shoot, but I think the West would prefer that to increase the anti-Russian sentiment in the world, because there are very few civilian casualties. This has been done in a very humanitarian way with corridors for civilians to escape from the cities that were being surrounded and the villages, and there has been a very light treatment. The internet, the phone system, the electricity in the Ukraine continues on. Russia has tried to disturb the life of people there as little as possible, but of course it has been disturbed, and there will certainly be long-term consequences of this. And the Russophobia has reached such a point that it has created barriers now between Russia and NATO and many other countries of the Western alliance, if you will, in which planes can no longer fly over Russian territory. Russian planes can't land in most of the Western countries. But it's going to increase the expense of flying and the time and even the feasibility. There is the gas, of course, has already gone up, and there will be a continual rise in prices. The shipping has stopped between going to and coming from Russia, which will cut a huge number of supplies of all kinds. This will have huge economic effects in the West as well as in Russia. And, of course, the food supply has been cut, and Russia and Ukraine together make up a huge amount of the wheat that is produced in the world and sent around the world, and that is now eliminated. And if you add that together with all of the other issues of the food supply in the world, we see a very much accelerated food shortage situation globally that will affect everyone. And the prices of food, if you can get it, are going to be going through the roof. But because of the barriers of trade in general, there will be many items that we have taken for granted as being available that no longer will be. This will probably include construction materials and fixtures and things like that that get imported. So it's going to affect people at all levels of society. Also, there's been a communication break. I don't know if you're aware of it, but Russia Today, Sputnik are intermittently unavailable even here, but in many places completely blocked. Russia has now, of course, done the same with the Western media. So the Iron Curtain is back and much stronger than ever before. And this is now in a very dangerous mode because of the absurdly irresponsible statements being made by U.S. leaders, like telling people in Russia to assassinate their president, which can have huge effects and obviously is not going to make Mr. Putin very happy. And that will have consequences. But also talk of a no-fly zone, which would lead, as Putin himself said, I think today, that there would be war instantly, that instant, with whatever countries attempted that. So even though today I actually wrote in an email that I didn't think a nuclear war was in the immediate future, I actually have to withdraw that. It may well be because of the insanity of the people who have some political power, who have all seemed to gone mad. And Russians are being fired from jobs. Many of them are being expelled from different countries. You can't. Italy is now not allowing people to study Dostoevsky. You know, it's reached incredible levels of insanity. The situation is ratcheting up. It's not cooling down, even though the war itself, to the extent that it really should be called that, is nearly over. But I don't think that's going to end the tensions. In fact, I think they will continue to increase. The one thing that the West has not done is to stop the shipment of gas and oil from Russia that they want. But it may well be that Russia chooses not to sell it to the West under these conditions, which would, of course, create even far more amplified effects. So we're at a situation now where the state of the world and the fragility of the various social systems throughout the world are beginning to really shake at their foundations, and the decomposition of the fabric of society is well underway. And this could, of course, be magnified many times if China takes advantage of the situation to go into Taiwan, which is not unlikely as well. So we have a situation where war is ever more likely every day, nuclear war. So in this situation, the attainment of liberation from the illusion of being a body is not just a luxury to put off to some future lives. It's something that would be of very practical value in the immediate future, if not right now. So I think that it should inspire us to make extra efforts and to be able to disseminate peace from our own fortunate place of having a refuge to those in the world and in the morphogenetic field in which we are all entangled as a single consciousness, to send out that peace to all the souls who are suffering and who are in anxiety and who are in war zones and who are perhaps in dire straits in terms of not having availability of nourishment. So that I think is one of the duties of the bodhisattva, to offer that kind of compassionate help on a spiritual level and to help those who are leaving the body under those conditions to be able to reach the light of God and find peace, if not in the body, at least afterwards. And we have that ability to be of service if we ourselves have reached the light and are able to transmit it. So that's the situation, I think. The other aspect of it is because all of the media are now so focused on the war politics, the pharmaceutical companies have taken advantage of the fog of war to release documents that they had held back in the past about all the adverse effects that the jab causes, and although many people may not be paying attention to it, but that information is out there now in a much more, let's say, admitted state. And even though probably nothing will be done on a legal level about that, but at least it will have an awakening effect on those who are able to find that information, whether they have already been jabbed or not. So that's also going to have a political effect on the populations who will have, I assume, in some cases at least, a great deal of anger and sorrow and of confusion. So we want to be of help to those as well and to all the people who have been affected by this situation, to send them divine peace, to recognize that we are not bodies, and the illness, incapacity, or death of the body, or any painful symptom that the body might suffer, does not need to have a negative effect upon one if one is in Atman consciousness. One can abide in peace regardless of the state of one's body. And as yogis, we need to reach that state ourselves and then be able to transmit that power that we have proven is real, is genuine, to those who are in need of attaining that level of their being. So that's the news from Lake Wobegon, as used to be said on a program that I think is probably gone long ago. So let's talk about a little bit about the Tao, if you wish. And we can, of course, I'll open the floor afterwards, and if anyone has any comments or to make about the current situation or where it is leading, I'll be glad to go back into it. Most people want an ego liberated from suffering, but they don't want a consciousness liberated from the ego. This is the problem that even yogis seem to have. You can't reach liberation from suffering without annihilating the ego illusion, because the ego is the source of suffering. But it's also the source of the crumbs of jouissance that the consciousness holds on to, that give it an illusion of some kind of control, power, enjoyment, and ability to think its way out of difficult situations that it doesn't want to let go of in order to achieve the beatitude of union with God. But it is only the extinguishing of the ego illusion that will bring liberation from our pain and our destiny of going around the wheel of rebirth again and again. And this is the moment, the last moment, in which liberation is attainable. The window of opportunity will close, at least in a practical sense, when the situation becomes more extreme, as it will very soon. So the Tao is the way of achieving that liberation. And that's what we want to focus on. Actually, the Tao has two foci. I should probably elaborate on both. So the Tao of non-action, the Tao of action that is non-action, the Wu Wei, this is the use of the principles of spirituality in order to know how to navigate through the world so long as the body is alive, and how to act in such a way to optimize the outcome of the events in your life, how to make wise decisions, how to act at the right moment without waiting too long so that the window of opportunity closes on you, how to know which is the right fork in the road to take. All that wisdom, that intuitive function of the mind that comes from the transcendent connection to the Atman can only be opened, awakened, and accurately perceived by the Buddhi at the Viveka point. So and this is an assemblage point just beyond the reach of the ego. So we have to get at least into soul consciousness to have that Tao of action to be activated. And the Tao of liberation requires, of course, going even beyond that. So the first level of the Tao, we could say, is the focus on how to live, how to make decisions, how to persevere, how to have the ability to connect with other people in a way that maximizes cooperation and the achievement of collective goals, and of maintenance of harmony in a community, for example. So all of that is part of this level of the Tao. The Tao is the general intelligence that opens up at the soul level, that enables us to know what to do and what not to do, and to enable us to read other people. To know who we should even be making connections with, and what connections could actually be lead to adverse effects, to use that phrase in this context, because there are people whose karma and whose projections are so negative that a naive kind of connection will lead to you being the toxic waste dump of those negative energies. And one has to know how to deal with that with compassion and wisdom, but at the same time without being a victim. So there's a dharma of great subtlety that's involved in recognizing the Tao. One has to be free oneself from negative energies in order not to to inflict them on other people as well. So there's an ethic that is a part of the Tao, and a need to have a very strong moral courage to not make judgments, negative projections, accusations, etc., without blinding oneself to what is happening at the subconscious level and in the stream of karma and sanskaras of other beings. So to be able to be of optimal help to them, but also to not get entangled in any streams of, let's say, karmic obligation that could hinder one's ascension and one's development in the world, free of ultimately the kind of negativity that creates a hostile, dependent relation to others that is a lose-lose for all parties in a relationship. So there has to be a great deal of the power to recognize that love often has to mean leaving, not staying, not going back, not trying to rescue, but separating in order to reach a high enough state that one is able to help the other rather than to be trapped in the other's frame of reference, in which the projections on one actually disempower one and cause one to lose the ability to really serve the other that one's own love has caused one to go toward in order to be of help. So there's a lot of self-sabotage that happens at the ego level through its ignorance of its own limitations, its wishful thinking, and its inability to see clearly what its true duty is in relation to God and in relation to humanity, to family systems, and to social orders, etc. All of that has to be put into the right perspective in order for clear and accurate decisions and assessments to be made. So that's that level of the Tao. And I just wanted to outline it tonight, but that's part of what's in the book that we're going to be studying. But for us, particularly as satyogis who are on the path of ascension, it is very important that we not fall from the viveka point in order to be able to live in that level of the Tao and keep the community free from those kinds of negative projections that can create schisms and create the kind of, let's say, negative karmic detritus that produces a bitter taste in the energy field. We have to keep the honey of divine love flowing in order to keep the community successful and able to thrive in this time in which hatred and anger and all the other negative energies are at loose in the world, so that we're not contaminated by them. So that's that's all I think I'll say for this evening on the Tao of non-action. But I hope that's a useful orientation that will help you see that focus in the book as well. But the other focus is the Tao of liberation, and that's what I'd like to speak more about this evening, because that's our primary responsibility and hopefully our primary inspiration and intention to attain. I was reading Sat Purusha Mangat Ram again today. I go back to reading him from time to time. He's an extremely astute student, teacher of human consciousness. And a few points he got began to mobilize my own buddhi to consider that this path of liberation actually for sat yogis has three, we could say, parallel routes or pathways to liberation, not just one. So I'm going to label them. First about this. So the first way of attaining liberation for a sat yogi, because this is a jnana path, a path of knowledge, a path of understanding, a path of analysis of our own consciousness, and using those analytic powers to deconstruct the ego, its resistances, its defenses, its censor, its subconscious fantasies, etc. The path of the jnana yajna, which yajna of course means the sacrificial fire, and jnana is of course the fire of knowledge. Then, for those whose ego is still alive and well and resisting one's ascension, one has to be very dedicated to examining it constantly and deconstructing it and getting to the root of its tenacity to hold on and resist the ascension into union with the Godhead. Why isn't that happening instantly? Since it's a fact that we are that, there is only one self, why are we still in duality? That encountering the resistance head on, directly, facing it and deconstructing it, but accepting it, not running away from it, not denying it, but accepting our own resistance and our own let's say, choice to suffer as an ego rather than to attain the blissful liberation of a God consciousness, we need to be able to sit in that fire of suffering consciously and endure the pain of it until that fire itself dissolves the ego. The moth has to stay in the flame. It can't just circle around it and get its wings singed occasionally. It has to go all the way in and sacrifice itself in the fire, but to remain conscious the entire time of all of the subtle learnings that come up as the wings of the moth burn and as its body burns, as the body of the ego burns. But it will reveal all of its secrets to you if you don't run away from the fire. And those secrets then produce tremendous wisdom. Okay? So for some who are doing Atmanology sessions, those sessions can be very painful. They can be very threatening. They can be very even destabilizing. because they reveal, they bring out of the subconscious hiding places all of those tendencies and their roots that the sensor doesn't want your conscious mind to see. So it will increase the burning, and that's why some people run away from doing sessions, or at least from certain kind of interpretations, and tend to want to forget them immediately rather than to process them fully and to really get to the root of it and sit in it long enough that one's identification with a certain sanskara melts down through its irrational absurdity as one recognizes one's own attachment to that which is sabotaging one's own liberation. But it has to be a totally conscious decision that is carried out without backing away or justifying one's taking one's time or taking one's attention into other directions. It has to be held until ultimately the I thought itself, which is the core of one's attachment, the object of attachment, is burned away in that fire. Okay, so that's the first way. It's a way that that is very painful, but that that brings the result of a tremendous amount of knowledge of how the ego is structured, what its dynamic is, how it functions to hold you back and others, and actually the result of that is you will become an Atmanologist. You will understand the Atman and its derivatives of soul and ego, and you will know how to help others to withdraw those supplementary vessels of the ego's of the soul and the of the Atman's being back into its original nature and dissolve those projective spider webs that have connected one to an enmeshment in the body and the body's family and the body's nationality, religion, social system, etc. So all of those attachments and connections to the unreal have to be fully recognized and accepted for what they are in order to outgrow those anchors that keep one installed in a phenomenal illusory identity. Okay, so that's the way of the jnana yoga. It's not for everyone. So the second option is the way of Mahabhava. Mahabhava. Bhava, the word, it actually means spirit, but not spirit in the same sense as Atman, as the spirit, an entity, a substance, a being. But to be in high spirits, right? To be in the great spirit of love for God. That's the Mahabhava. So it's a bhakti path, a path in which your dedication to God, your surrender to God, your love for God is so great that it brings you to a blissful state. It's the opposite of the first path. It's not a path of suffering. I recommend it highly, but many people don't have love for God and they cannot authentically follow the way of Mahabhava. It's quick, it's beautiful, it's joyous, but it's, again, it's not for everyone. Not everyone has the simplicity and the willingness to be fully pervaded by God. The ego defends against that. It wants its own pseudo-autonomy. It doesn't want to surrender. It doesn't want to obey. It doesn't want to be lost in a higher consciousness. It wants its own separate little kingdom. So then it has to take the Jnana Yajna path. But if you are willing to forego that illusory power of the ego and willing to surrender and feel love for God and the joy of God's presence, which is here if you attune to it, and if you want to be a servant of God and a transmitter of the energy of God, and you're fully ready to let go of the ego because of the joy of ascension and liberation from the plane of suffering, then the way of Mahabhava is very quick and very, very delightful. And the nectar of immortality flows very readily. So it's a very beautiful path. But again, not everyone can take that path. It's not something that you can say, okay, I want vanilla or I want chocolate, you know. Some people have to take the path that requires a lot of suffering. And it's not like a worse or a lower path, but it is the karmic choice that the soul made before this lifetime because it needed to learn certain things to undo its own karma and to be able to serve in a particular way that the one who takes the path of Mahabhava cannot function in the same way. Because there is in effect no functioning anymore except joy, laughter, you know, and the contagious transmission of luminous, beautiful love. Okay, that's wonderful. And I hope we have some Mahabhava followers here. But that is a very rare path for people in the West because they were trained either to have only the thinking function operating or to love only people on the phenomenal plane, not to have love for God, rather than love for humans and for their pets and for, you know, nature and for their next meal and all of those things. The love of God is very ethereal, very unmanifest, very subtle, obviously. And even the idea of God, having been ridiculed for so long in the West, will cause one to be in many situations an outcast, or one will project that one will be seen as foolish for being so happy, you know. So not everyone can get over the inhibition that is the main obstacle to the way of Mahabhava. But I hope some of you will choose that and shine with that love light, because that's certainly an important part of our mission here as satyogis. But for that, all the traces of anger and sadness and disappointment and all the things that the ego carries as its baggage and the projections that causes has to be let go out of love for God. Without processing it, it just still has to be let go. And if that's available to you, if your heart can open to that extent, I recommend it. Mm-hmm. Then there's the third. I'm calling it the way of Shunya, not because of any personal reasons, but it's the accurate word for this path. Shunya meaning emptiness, nothingness, stillness. It is the recognition, which takes a great deal of honesty, that your ego doesn't really exist. It really is an illusion, a fabrication. And the way of Shunya is simply to empty yourself of ego. Not out of bliss, because you don't feel the bliss of love for God. And you also don't need to do any processing. All that is really needed is to be empty. That's all. But to be really empty, to be empty of the I thought, and be empty of the belief in others and in wanting anything from the world, an emptiness that has completely disinvested in the phenomenal plane, an emptiness in which you are literally no one, literally nothingness itself. And that is the truth. We are nothing. We are absolutely unmanifest awareness, but that is no thing. That is nothing. And when the body dies, if we are not in the bliss of God consciousness or we have not reached that level, we will feel that. And this is why people fear death. They fear the void. They fear the nothingness. They fear the lack of love, the lack of others, making them an object of desire, etc. But to be in that emptiness is to let go of all hope, to abandon all fantasies of fulfillment on the phenomenal plane, and to recognize your aloneness, because we are all alone. And that is the truth. And it's in that aloneness, then, that the ego will dissipate. It will no longer attract the attention. The mental chatter will not have our interest, and it will extinguish by itself. And in that emptiness, there won't be any suffering. There won't be any bliss. But there will be total peace, parashakti, absolute peace. And that absolute peace actually is even higher than the bliss of the Mahabhava. Even the one in Mahabhava will eventually have to go beyond the bliss into that which is even beyond nothingness. It can't be called anything. It's inconceivable. When you reach the absolute, there is no you, there is no God, there is no world, there is nothing that can be conceived of. So there's no point in speaking about it. Yes, in the infinite consciousness of the Godhead, but no, there's no way to describe what that is. One, it has to be known through the letting go, the entire letting go. And for some, that's the only path that's available, is emptiness. They don't have the love, they don't have the desire, or perhaps even the ability to process. But the emptiness, the letting go, is always available to everyone. And again, this is an immediate path. If you're willing to let go of all illusions, all desires, all the chatter of the ego, that emptiness is your condition right now. It's what is real. And so any of these paths can lead to instant liberation. And depending on one's temperament, one path or another may be more attractive. But ultimately, we really have no choice. We will be drawn to whatever path is open to us. Not all of them are open. For some, actually, all three are open. And for some, there will have to be a combination, a mixture, some burning away in the fire and some bliss and some emptiness. And it will depend on the assemblage point of one's journey through the Kundalini map, that at different points, different ways of liberation from that level of consciousness will be accessible and will reveal itself. But any of these can bring you to liberation here and now. And it's a matter of recognizing what one's soul has chosen for one's ego complex. If we wanted to relate these to, let's say, Kashmir Shaivism, or even just, let's start with Advaita Vedanta, we could say that This is clearly chit. This is clearly sat. This is clearly ananda. So the entirety of Brahman, sat, chit, ananda, is contained in these three ways. We could also relate it to Kashmir Shaivism and say that the anavapaya is the jnana yagya, because that's working on the individual dynamics of the ego. And the mahabhava is the shaktapaya, because you're not using your mind, you're just using your heart. And the way of shunya is the shambhavopaya, which is simply the letting go, a single act of will. We could also say that to use the tantric Buddhist map, that the jnana yagya represents the nirmanakaya, the mahabhava is the sambhogakaya, and the shunyata is the dharmakaya. So the same concepts and the same ways are taught in all the spiritual paths. We could go through many others and find that same triad of routes to liberation. But for us, this is the easiest way to delineate them. And as I say, there's no time frame involved. These are all beyond time and beyond any limitation in how fast you can let go of or burn away the obstacles. And all of it can be simply left behind in a moment when there is total surrender. For some, surrender is impossible because they have to be dominant. If you have an ego that needs to be dominant, use that domination by not wanting to remain simply in the third assemblage point, where you have the will to power at a level which is unreal. But who is really dominant is the Lord of life, the Lord of the universe. And so through realizing your oneness with God, then the ego's yearning for power is achieved. So rather than fighting that desire, use it to rise. And if it is a desire to surrender, to be loved, then use that to be completely ravished by the presence of God and brought into that ultimate union. And if the thinking function is dominant and one wants to understand reality and all of its complex fractal dimensions, etc., use that to bring yourself into the jnana yagya and stay with the truth of everything that arises without deceiving yourself one bit, and you will be liberated. So whether it's a path of truth, of love, or of power, all will take you to the same place. But you have to be rigorous, and you have to be completely accurate in your willingness to face the real, and to face your attachment to the unreal in order to reach the real. Okay, I think I've said all that I intended to pass on to you. I hope it's been of some help. And so I'll open the floor. Nirgun?
Thank you, Shunya, for tonight's class. I don't know what the movie was going to be, but this was better.
That I can guarantee.
I wondered if you could speak more a little bit about the combination, and I tell you for why I ask, of all three paths. Because I find myself called to being on the way of Jnana Yagya, mm-hmm. and this is what this school does so well as well. But I find when I'm rigorous with the work and able to, in sessions, process those things that are coming up and apply the teachings, etc., the heart opens and mm-hmm. I'm able to love mm-hmm. truly. And then when the heart opens, it opens enough to be able to tolerate the void. Mm-hmm. But then there's a whiplash in either of the second two paths that, okay, back to the fire, back to the jnana, mm-hmm. back to the yagya. But is that, so could you speak mm-hmm. a little bit?
Yeah, more? No, I think that's a not untypical situation that one has to face. And you have to, at the very moment where the whiplash begins, you have to see what was the thought, what's the impulse, what's the drive, and get to the root of it, and stay in the fire of it, and of what part of you is making the choice to whip you back into Maya, and you have to then overpower that impulse, but you can only do it if there is total understanding. And love for that higher power that is free of that impulse, and the let's say the fantasy that drives it, right? So indeed, all three paths are united in that situation. So I agree, it's a very good example. For some people, they don't go through that. They can sit in the fire and not, or they can sit in the emptiness, and they're not whiplashed back. Or at least if there is a terror of the emptiness, of the void, they can endure it until it dissolves without having to process it analytically. But not for some, the processing is essential. And it's useful, and it helps one to understand, to help others. So it's an excellent situation to be in, and to recognize that it is giving you a complete picture of the paths of God that are open from the Creator, and that you are being able to know all of them firsthand. So it's an excellent gift. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, it seems to me that also these A, B, and C options also relate to translation, transcendence, and transformation, it seems to me, mm-hmm. in that
That's
way,
true.
Which is what we understand here. But my question was more, how do these three paths relate to the functions? The four functions, and then, of course, the transcendent, because if it's the path to liberation, we want to reach the transcendent function, or activate, maybe is a better word, the transcendent function. And it seems that, of course, the thinking function, you mentioned it, is the way of the jnana yagya. The feeling seems to me that of Mahabhava, but also you have mentioned in the past that you need to activate all of the functions in order to be able to then, let's say, I don't know if it's awaken the transcendent function or stimulate the transcendent function. Could you speak a little more about that?
Yeah, all three of these paths require all the functions, mm-hmm. but one uses those functions differently. Because yes, of course, in the jnana yagya, you have to use the thinking function, but you have to analyze the feeling function, particularly when there are negative emotions that don't want you to burn the ego, right, that are holding on to jouissance or attachments, etc. So, and you have to analyze the sensing function that wants to keep the senses having certain kinds of experiences, right? So the attachments are there in all of the functions. And then even the thinking function has to be thrown in the fire eventually, so that even thinking is given up, because that's usually the ultimate attachment of the person who is in that path. And in the same way, the Mahabhava, even though it's total dedication and love for God, which also activates one's other functions because one has a much more heightened sensory awareness of the world, a much more clarity about what's going on on the thinking level, etc. And the intuition clearly is very open. But one has to transcend all of that and transcend even the feeling function to get to the final union with God, because it is love for union, and when the union is achieved, that becomes an obstacle, right? So in a way, all of the functions are useful to a point, and then it is the letting go of them that it brings one to the liberation, right? You're being liberated from those functions because they are functions of the ego and even of the soul that are ultimately entangled in the phenomenal unreality that you want to let go of. So it's a total death to all of that. And then the God function opens up, even beyond the transcendent function, but that's no longer from the same individual level of consciousness. So, and in the shunya path of emptying, then you're really letting go of all the functions directly and consciously in order to be in that functionless emptiness without thought, without desire, without interest. But because you are totally emptied out, you are also then filled, and then that higher function will take over. So it's, in a way, it's the same but different in the way that the functions are employed and then let go of in all three paths. Okay.
Okay, thank you. So what's unclear to me is I understand that once, I think I heard you say that you need to activate all of the functions first in order to initiate the transcendent function. However, the last one seems, no, you just let go of all the functions at the same time in order to enter the emptiness. But does the stimulation of all the functions, is it necessary for the other paths, the other two options?
It's necessary for all three.
For all three.
Yeah, because you cannot get to the emptiness until all of your functions have been opened up and activated. Mm. You can't let go of a function that hasn't yet become manifest. So if it's still latent, it has to be activated and then abandoned. But it has to be completely recognized as one of those potentialities of the soul, but also of the ego, that if it hasn't developed, it's because there have been inhibitions and obstacles to, let's say, the development of a thinking function in someone or a sensing function, whatever it might be. And one has to let go of what is the root of the inhibition, right? Which is a certain self-image or identification, maybe with a parent or with a projection that was made upon one. So there still has to be that awareness of all of the psychological factors and vectors that have been holding the ego complex in place in order to let go of it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Namaste, Shunya. Thank you for this. This is way better than a movie.
Especially,
it would be anything like last Saturday. But my question is along the same lines as Nirguna's, and it really, your answer really helped, including his explanation. I am very much stuck between A and B. However, I must say that my love for God is exponentially is growing exponentially. However, the more I grow upward, the more the suffering wants to pull me downward. And I'm understanding that it's also that comfort in the suffering and just accepting that that's all the ego knows. And so I... my question for you is, can I keep... You're saying that this is more of being drawn to a path rather than a will or a choice, but, I mean, I was wondering if I could just continue to empower the B drive, that Mahabhava, and that in itself would... keep me from having to sit in the fire of more suffering, of sitting through it more, if one can not necessarily override the other, but be just as powerful as having to go through two paths or three paths.
Well, that will have to be determined through your own experimentation.
Yeah.
If you do have that amount of love for God, that you have no interest in the phenomenal plane and in the identification with the ego in your past and the story that the ego tells and its projections, that love will indeed dissolve that ego complex because it's no longer you, it's just a past remnant of a memory, and all of that will dissolve in love. But if it doesn't happen, and you find yourself going back into a mode of suffering or in a mode in which the ego is acting out and you're not in a state of divine love, then you have to be fully cognizant and honest with that and sit in the fire of that suffering and accept the fact that there is still a sanskara that is choosing the ego and is choosing to express some negative emotion, let's say, or negative interrelationship with someone or something or the whole phenomenal plane. And one has to sit in the acceptance of that, along with all of the suffering that it causes through the karmic backlash, without running away into love, because it can be a flight into love, and in which the love is not totally authentic, and it's more a defense against the fire, and you have to sit in it until it has really been burned away completely. So that will take a great deal of truthfulness with yourself, and really a sense of what your heart really is yearning for. Because if the love of God is pure and real, then yes, it will take you out of that situation, and the situation won't repeat. But if you find a certain kind of pattern repeating, then you really have to take the path of jnana, yajna, until it is completely eliminated.
I think you may have answered my second question in a way.
Okay.
I'll just throw it out there just in case. You can burn it if you'd like. But... how, so the Kundalini map, I'm trying to unstick myself from the knowledge and the just my interpretations of the importance of having to build each of the chakras to strengthen them so one keeps from falling back into them. And so is that still the case now, you know, if we're just one push away from nuclear war and it's very necessary that each of us liberate now? So rather than going through all the details of the principles of the Kundalini map and focusing on trying to, well, I'll just leave it there, but is the love for the union with God going to repair the
deficits in childhood development that have created weak assemblage points? The first three assemblage points are the problem. The other assemblage points are not an issue, because you will ascend the Kundalini to chakra 7 very easily if you have resolved the issues that bring you back to the first three assemblage points, all right? And most of the issues are actually in the first two. And it's the weakness of the first two that sometimes cause one to hold on to the third assemblage point as a defense against collapse into a meltdown. But it's only those. And indeed, they can be repaired through feeling God's love, make up for the lack of parental love and the lack of all of the things that you didn't get in childhood. It can do that. And the love will also bring in a certain amount of jnana, because as the assemblage point is repaired, there will be ahas, there will be a recognition of now you feel a certain ability to relate to others that you didn't before because of some sense of inadequacy or lack that was affecting your ability to feel okay with people, whatever. I'm just making generalized statements. But if those first two assemblage points become strong, and they refer to the ideal ego and the capacity to let go of the mother and the including the lack of a mother or the emotional deadness or oppressiveness of the relation with the mother or with the family system in general. If one is able to let go of those because now one feels the support and the love of God, then indeed one will also let go of the third assemblage point, because one will want the wisdom, the love, the joy, and the ultimate real mastery that will come at chakra 6 and chakra 7 that will then enable a very quick rise. So it doesn't necessarily have to take a lot of time, is the summation of all of that. But in one way or another, those assemblage points do have to be repaired. They're like rungs of a ladder, and if you can't step on them and climb above them, they may become obstacles to rising. But if you have been able to get beyond them, then indeed, there's no reason to go back just for the intellectual, you know, knowledge of it, and it will take care of itself. But again, you can't know that from within. So you will know it through your own experimentation. If you find yourself falling back into one of those three assemblage points in the lower level, then I would sit in the Jnana Yajna. I would do sessions focusing on the particular issues that are bringing you down, or to act out in a way, and to resolve that as quickly as possible. And then the rocket will take off and you'll find yourself in chakra 7.
Thank you so much. I feel like you've really been speaking to the majority of the struggles and sitting in the fire for the last week. And this has been incredibly helpful.
Good.
Thank
I'm
you
so glad.
For coming tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having tonight. It's been a beautiful teaching, although kind of difficult to hear on my way home. It's kind of an interesting goodbye. So really appreciate the goodbye, and I just thank the community very much for opening your hearts to me for the past month and allowing me to be in this space to go through a lot of A, B, and C, particularly A. And it's been a lot of work, and just being in a space that is so contained so that I can go through that is very much appreciated. Thank you. On number two, going back to all the difficulties that are happening in the world, coming here, I had a lot of triggers talking about things like this, and tonight I don't have any. I'm just actually able to look at the hypocrisy and how we're judging what's going on in another part of the world when not very long ago we did the same in Iraq and invaded a country, and now we're blaming others. And it kind of reminds me of what I've gone through in my classes in Atmanology, like realizing how I'm projecting these things onto other people, and that's what we're doing as a collective right now. And then on the third point, I'm working very hard on number A, letter A, but on B I have a lot of difficulty around with the connection to God, because of the reasons that you've said, that I grew up in a society that villainized that. And I really struggle with it. And I kind of came into, I've in the past few years stopped having this strong love for individuals and having more of a love for everything, the plants and the animals, and you touched on that. And I'm hoping that maybe that's where I can put a seed that is the soil that creates the plant that is able to connect to God. I'm asking, is that, do you think that would be a good way to look at that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think any love that you feel and the recognition that a being, a great being, created all of this. They didn't create themselves. This is really the creation of God. The love of any creature is also implicitly a love of that creator, and the more explicit you make, the more I think the love will develop for the entire ecosystem in which all the creatures are kept and sustained, and the recognition that you yourself have grown only through the connections and love that you have had with others, and the support and the dialogue and the exchanges. Even here, what you have learned has changed you. You've grown, right? So there must be some love for that connection and that relationality that enables you to grow to higher levels of consciousness and the ability to be of service in the world and help others. So the love will tend to augment and exponentially increase the more you have gratitude for all that has been received, and then recognize how much more there can be through your surrender to love and to the intelligence that has created all of this.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Vayu.
Namaste. Здравствуйте. The pronunciation in Russian. with my departure, I wrote that even though the image is changing, that inner knowing of where home is can't be changed anymore, and it's because of what I've learned here at Sat Yoga. The truth that I witnessed, it can't be unseen. Everything other than this is an illusion. I really appreciated this point about acceptance and instinctive choices, I think. Accepting the karmic consequences that come with instincts and using that to burn it in the fire. And to burn, like, what is it that caused that, and not to go into this melodrama of the ego that it so wants to do. An instinctive choice is what brought me here in the first place. And now with the wisdom, it's the hope and strength and clarity of the full commitment, the full haji, the full lack of hesitation that will bring me here in return. It's not being half pregnant in my devotion to this. That's my true yearning and the full trust in this path rather than the shakiness. And then lastly, just the gratitude to you, to the Sangha, to the community, for the love and the light, and igniting like a spark or an inner fire that I couldn't recognize, and how grateful I am to seeing that is how much pain it can bring and how much bliss it can bring at the same time. There's this Thich Nhat Hanh quote of, once you see the truth, suffering cannot be avoided. And I also think that in the truth, bliss cannot be avoided if you're fully embarking on the path too. So I wanted to say thank you for showing me the real and for showing me the truth of who I am. Thank you.
Thank you. Ultimately, the suffering and the bliss are one. And if you're in the recognition of that, then liberation is here now. So, blessings. Is there anyone else before we adjourn? Any burning questions or emptying questions or loving questions? Yeah, Kalyan, you can have the last word.
I didn't want to ask this question to take away from this teaching and this beautiful discussion, but I actually had a question about the first part of the teaching on more of the phenomenal plane.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not clear to me what the reason, let's say, is for the invasion of Ukraine. You mentioned to destabilize or demilitarize.
Demilitarize, actually. Demilitarize. Demilitarize. This was provoked by the U.S. It's the U.S. that they've been saying Russia's going to invade Russia for months and months, and Russia didn't. I had no interest in it. It was only when it was finally said that Ukraine would be admitted to NATO and missiles would be put into Ukraine that would be 3 minutes away from Moscow that Russia said, no, we can't do that. And then they had to act before that would take place. And so it was a completely defensive last resort on their part. And Putin begged the West, please don't force me to do this. They didn't want to do it. And then they had no choice as an existential matter of survival that they had to turn Ukraine into a buffer state so that the NATO missiles would not be that close to their border. So most experts, even in the West, recognize that. They don't blame him for this. And the Russians really did, as humanitarian as possible, an approach to demilitarizing the country. They don't want to own it. They don't want to make it part of Russia. I don't think they're going to do any annexation. The Donbass republics that already broke away will stay independent, but neutral or pro-Russia. And central Ukraine may either become part of that or a separate country, and Western Ukraine, they're not even going near that, and that was not part of Russia. You know, Central and Eastern Ukraine were historically part of Russia since the beginning, for thousands of years, we're talking about, since Tartaria. But the West was part of Poland. It was in a different sphere of influence, and they're not messing with that. They're not interested, and so they're stopping at Kiev. But there may be a rump state that remains in, let's say, the Western sphere, but it will be further away from the border of Russia and not as much of a danger to their existence. But I think that the result will be a neutrality of a new Ukraine or a new set of smaller countries that will not be a danger to the status quo.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Okay. All right. Well, I hope that this has been helpful to people and we can stay in our upward path and not get bogged down with too much obsession with what's happening in the war zones of the world and remain at peace in the only zone in which there is peace, which is God consciousness. And not fall into Maya as a result of the world coming to the end of Kali Yuga, which we have predicted for how many years now? So it's happening, and we shouldn't be surprised or worried or concerned. It's all a blessing. And I have a feeling that the world will be taken out of its misery sooner rather than later. So we should be prepared for that, and we should already be ascended from any body consciousness. And so I hope that everyone takes that very seriously and takes one of these three paths, or all three, and reaches liberation so that we can serve others who still need some help to rise into the light and the love and the bliss of God consciousness. Blessings to all of you on your path. Namaste. Namaste. I didn't read from Sat Purusha. I'll do that next time.